We go. We're on chapter 7. Last week we went through chapter 6, and it's a somewhat short chapter. Chapter 7 is a long chapter, so we're probably not going to make it through chapter 7. Actually, we're not going to make it through chapter 7 because I didn't go that far in my notes. So, if you remember that Stephen was preaching, and he was one of those seven guys that got chosen to wait on tables, and he was full of spirit, or it says full of grace, and believing, and he spoke the word, and many signs and wonders were doing, and then these guys from this certain synagogue started asking him questions, and they could not resist what he spoke. And so then they dragged them to the temple, to the high priest, and to the council. So that's where we kind of left off. But it says that in chapter 6, verse 13, it says, they set up false witnesses, which said, this man, speaking about Stephen, ceaseth not to speak blasphemous words against this holy place, against the temple, and the law. For we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth shall destroy this place and shall change the customs which Moses delivered us. And all that sat in the council, that would be the Sanhedrin, looked steadfastly on him and saw his face as it had been of an angel or a messenger. Then said the high priest, are these things so? What things? Well, that Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place, the temple? And are you here to change the customs that Moses gave? And the word customs is the word ethos. I guess that's where we use the word ethos, don't we, in English? Yeah, like ethics. It means here manner or usage. Then we have Stephen's response. He gives an eloquent summation of the Old Testament and the history of Israel as proof that Jesus of Nazareth was the one prophesied of, meaning he would be the Messiah, the one that he was spoken of, the Christ, the anointed one. So, verse 2, he says, and he, Stephen, said, men and brethren, fathers, hearken, the God of glory appeared unto our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia, for he dwelt in Charan. Charan is C-H, but it's referring, and when we go back and look in Genesis, it's Haran, H-A-R-A-N, Haran. So the first thing he does is he points to the authority of Abraham, or he points to the life of Abraham, who, of course, everybody looked upon with great respect, and he was the patriarch of Israel. And it says, the God of glory appeared unto Abraham. So we're going to go to Genesis 11. But let's read verse 3 first, real quick. And he said unto him, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, thy relatives, thy family, and come into the land which I shall show thee. Okay, let's go to Genesis 11. Just to get an idea of what he's talking about here. And verse 31. And the verse 31. Then Terah took Abram. Abram is Abraham, right? Before God renamed him. God took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son. His brother had the same name as the city where they were going, coincidentally. And Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. Now the Lord had said unto Abraham, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. See, God had already said that. When they were in Ur of the Chaldees, God had told him to go. They went to Haran for whatever reason. Maybe Terah was old and couldn't travel anymore, and they waited for him to, nobody knows for sure. But they went there and they stayed there for a while. And then after he died, then it goes back and it says, the Lord had said, past tense, unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto a land that I will show thee. And I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great. And thou shalt be a blessing. I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken unto him. So we're going to jump back to Acts, but we're going to jump back and forth to the Old Testament, mostly to Genesis. So you might want to put a marker back in the beginning of Genesis somewhere so you can get there. And so the Lord had said unto Abraham, he had, before he even dwelled in Haran, he told him he was going to go into that land. And of course, Stephen, when he spoke, he quoted Genesis 12:1, right? He quoted the scripture. So verse 4, it says, then came he out of the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Charan, and from thence, when his father was dead, he removed him into this land wherein ye now dwell. Okay? Into Israel, the land of Israel, or, you know, what it was called here in the New Testament time, Judea. Verse 5, and he gave him none inheritance in it. He being God gave him, Abram, no inheritance in it. Not so much as to set his foot on. Or one of the translations says, not even a foot of it. I don't know, but whatever. You get the idea. He didn't own any of the land. Yet he promised that he would give it to him for a possession and to his seed after him, when as yet he had no child. So God did not at that time give Abraham the land. He promised it to him, that he would give it to him in the future and to Abraham's seed, even though Abraham was already old and childless. So I want to point out, you know, when referring to the seed of Abram or Abraham, it can represent two things: his children, his descendants or heirs. But it also can refer to the seed, the coming Messiah, that seed of the woman, which we read in Galatians. It talks about not as seeds as many, but one. And that seed is Christ, and it's referring to the Messiah. So whenever you read the seed, you got to look at the context. Sometimes it can refer to both at the same time. Okay, so verses 6 and 7. And God spake on this wise, that his seed would sojourn in a strange land. Sojourn means to travel through, or, you know, they were there, but they weren't citizens of that land, or they weren't born there. And that they should bring them into bondage and entreat them evil 400 years. And the nation to whom they shall be in bondage will I judge, said God, and after that they shall come forth and serve me in this place. So that's a quick summary of what's going to happen with Israel. You know, they're going to wander about in the promised land, then they're going to go into this land, and they're going to be put in bondage. They'll be there for 400 years. Now, they weren't in bondage for 400 years. We know that. But they were in bondage. But then when they came out, then God would take care of the country, which we know to be Egypt, and he would afflict them, and they would come into the land that he promised, and he would give it to them, right? So So let's see. He quoted Genesis again concerning Egypt and bondage and the call for Israel to serve him in the promised land. Verse 8, and he gave him the covenant of circumcision. So Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day, and Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. So that's the lineage, right? That's the lineage and the beginnings of Israel. Obviously, Abraham and Isaac were not Israelites because Jacob was renamed Israel and then he begot the 12 patriarchs, the 12 heads of the 12 tribes, and so they were called the children of Israel because they were Jacob's children, right, and descendants. But Abraham and Isaac were called Hebrews because they spoke Hebrew. That's why they're called Hebrews. Okay? So he gave him the covenant of circumcision. We're going to go back to Genesis. Now, when you give a covenant, that is a very solemn agreement. It's not just like today when we make a contract. It's more binding than just a contract. People would swear their lives when they made a covenant. They would, you know, realize that if they broke the covenant, they were in severe trouble. Today, people break contracts, sue each other, all kinds of stuff. But back in the biblical days, back in the time of Abraham, when you made a covenant, it was a very serious thing. And you can see how when God speaks to Israel in various places and he says, you know, if you break my covenant, you know, these bad things are going to happen to you. So Genesis 17, verse 1. And when Abraham was 90 years old and nine. We've gone a while. If we went back and read previously in the earlier chapters of Genesis, when God comes to him, Abraham was 70 and 5 years old, I believe, right? So now he's 90 and 9, so it's 24 years later. The Lord appeared unto Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect, and I will make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. So he doesn't even have one child, but God says, I'm going to multiply you exceedingly. And Abram fell on his face and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with thee, and thou shalt be a father of many nations. Neither shall thy name any more be called Abram, but thy name shall be called, shall be Abraham. Okay? For a father of many nations have I made thee. So he renames him, and he tells him, you're going to be a father of many nations. And I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee. He's kind of repeating some of the stuff he said before, but he's adding to it. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee and thy seed after thee and their generations for an everlasting covenant to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. So here again, he promises him the land, right? You know, now, Abraham was a stranger in that land, wasn't he? Because he didn't come from there. He came from Ur by way of Haran. And God said unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant, therefore thou and thy seed after thee in their generations. Meaning, seed here meaning what? His descendants, his heirs. This is my covenant which shall ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised. And ye shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, every man child in your generations. He that is born in the house or bought with money of any stranger, which is not of thy seed. He that is born in thy house and he that is bought with money must needs be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised man-child whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people, and he hath broken my covenant. And God said unto Abraham, as for Sarai, thy wife, thou shalt not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, which means princess. And I will bless her and give thee a son also of her. Yea, I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be of her. Then Abram fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, shall a child be born unto him that is 100 years old? And shall Sarah that is 90 years old bear? And Abraham said unto God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. So he had had, what? Ishmael was a son he had had by way of Sarah's handmaid 13 years prior, and he loved Ishmael. And he said, what about Ishmael? And God said, Sarah, thy wife, shall bear thee a child indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his seed after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard thee. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and multiply him exceedingly. 12 princes shall he beget, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, which Sarah shall bear unto thee at this set time in the next year. And he left off talking with him, and God went up from Abraham. And Abraham took Ishmael, his son, and all that were born in his house, and all that were bought with money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskin in the selfsame day as God had said unto him. How did Abraham learn how to circumcise? That's my question. He wasn't a doctor. He didn't have surgical tools. And he had to circumcise himself. Wow. I guess God showed him what to do. And Abraham was 90 years old and 9 when he was circumcised in the flesh of his, maybe he didn't circumcise, maybe he showed somebody else how to do it and they did it for him. I don't know. And Ishmael, his son, was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. The same day was Abraham circumcised and Ishmael, his son, and all the men of his house, born in the house and bought with money of the stranger, were circumcised with him. So these guys were adults. You know, when you do a baby at 8 days old, they don't really remember, you know? But when you're older, it hurts and leaves you sore for a while. When my dad went into the Navy in World War I, he had to be circumcised. And that was true in the armed forces up until, you know, fairly recently. If you were uncircumcised, you had to be circumcised. They said they did it for health reasons. Then they realized it didn't really make a difference. But anyway. So if you want to find out how it affects an adult, go find somebody that was circumcised when they went back into the service. Let's go to Romans chapter 2. Still dealing with circumcision here because there's a point to it. It almost sounds funny, but you know what? When a man goes to the bathroom, what does he do? He holds himself, right? So every time he holds himself and that penis is circumcised, it reminds him of the covenant of God. Sounds silly to us, but you know what? Every day, 3-4 times a day maybe, they were reminded of the covenant. Chapter 2 of Romans, verse 25. For circumcision verily profiteth if thou keepeth the law. But if thou be a breaker of the law, thy circumcision is made uncircumcision. Therefore, if this uncircumcision keepeth the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted or accounted for circumcision? And shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfill the law, judge thee, who by the letter and circumcision dost transgress the law? For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh. But he is a Jew which is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit, and not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God. So, that's pretty cool. Because here we're talking about the New Testament. In the Old Testament, this was a sign to Abraham of the covenant that God would made with him. What covenant did he make with him? Well, he made a covenant that he was going to give him the promised land and that he was going to give him a male son and that he would be the father of many nations and kings would come out of him and the Messiah would come from his bloodline. That was all part of that covenant. Okay? Now, in Romans, you know, when the Jews are still holding on to the law and circumcision is a big matter of contention, Paul is teaching the Romans and he says, it has nothing to do with the physical circumcision, but it has to do with your attitude and your heart. Chapter 3, verse 1, it says, what advantage then hath the Jew? Or what profit is there of circumcision? Much every way, chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. Oracles would be the words of God. The word of God was given to them. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. As it is written, thou mightest be justified in thy sayings and mightest overcome when thou art judge. And goes on and talks more about other stuff. But let's look at verse 30. It says, seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision by believing and the uncircumcision through believing. See, and it was all about believing. Then in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, what shall we say then that Abraham, our father, pertaining to the flesh, hath found? For if Abraham were justified by works, he hath whereof to glory, but not before God. But for what saith the Scriptures? Abraham believed God, and it was counted or accounted unto him for righteousness. Okay? So what happened was, the righteousness of Abraham was because he believed, and circumcision was the result of his believing. God made a covenant with Abraham because he believed. Now, it was a one-way covenant in the sense of there was no negotiation, was there? Other than God said, or Abraham said, what about Ishmael? And God said, well, I'll take care of him. But other than that, the covenant was not with Ishmael, was it? It was with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob. And God reassured or reaffirmed that covenant with each one of those men. Pretty amazing. Romans chapter 4, we read a couple of verses. Let's go to verse 9. It says, cometh this blessedness then upon the circumcision only or upon the uncircumcision also? For we say that faith was reckoned or accounted to Abraham for righteousness. How was it then reckoned? When he was in circumcision or in uncircumcision? Not in circumcision, but in uncircumcision, right? God made the covenant with him, and then he said, this will be a sign of the covenant I have made with you. A sign, a reminder. You know, in modern times, when we make an agreement, we have a contract, and we have a signed agreement. That's the reminder of it. In this case, circumcision was the reminder. Verse 11, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of righteousness of the faith or believing, which he had yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them that believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also. And the father of the circumcision to them who are not of the circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of the faith or the believing of our father Abraham, which he had being yet uncircumcised. He wasn't circumcised when he believed God and God gave him the covenant, but then after he did, then God gave him circumcision as a sign, as a seal of the covenant between he and Abraham. Now what happened with Israel was they thought, well, we're circumcised, so we're righteous. They didn't realize they still had to believe. Okay. So it was a reminder to them of the covenant that was made, but they still had to believe. Back to Acts. So that's why it talks about circumcision there. Verse 9. And let's read verse 8 again, and then we'll keep going. And he gave him the covenant of circumcision. And so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him the eighth day. And Isaac begot Jacob, and Joseph begot the 12 patriarchs. And the patriarchs, moved with envy, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him. Wow. There's a lot there. And we're going to look at some of the record of Joseph, and you're going to go to Genesis 37. Told you it's going to be hard to get through this chapter quick. But there's so much good stuff, and you see how Stephen handles it and how he talks and the purpose of it. The purpose of it is to what? Prove that Jesus is the Christ. That's the whole purpose of him speaking to them and bringing up all this stuff. Genesis 37 and verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel was Jacob, right? Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac begot Esau and Jacob. Jacob was the one that had favor with God. He believed God. God renamed him Israel, right? Okay. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors, which really means it was a designated him as a favored son. And when his brethren saw that their fathers loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren. And they hated him yet more. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood around about and made obeisance to my sheaf. A sheaf is what? A bundle of hay or whatever. And his sheaf stood up, and their sheaves made obeisance, means they bowed down to him, or his sheaf. So his brothers weren't happy about that. You know, it's like Andrew telling his brothers, I'm in charge now, which he'd like to do, I'm sure. And his brethren said unto him, shalt thou indeed reign over us, or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dream and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream and told his brethren and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and your mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? And his brethren envied him, and his fathers observed the saying. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock of Shechem. Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, See whether it will be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me a word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked, saying, What seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, They are departed hence, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. Wow. Nice brothers. They said, We want to kill him. And they were not happy at all with Joseph. And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him and cast him into some pit. And we will say, Some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it. Reuben was one of the 12 brothers. He was the oldest. And he said, And he delivered him out of their hands and said, Let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. And it came to pass, when Joseph was come unto his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. And they took him and cast him in the pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, and going to carry it down to Egypt. Who are the Ishmaelites? Their cousins. Remember Ishmael? That's his cousins, Ishmaelites. And they're going down to Egypt to make some money. And Judah said unto his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him. You know, we're not going to get anything out of killing him. Let's sell him, make some money on this deal. Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh. And his brethren were content. Them were there passed by Midianites, merchantmen. And they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph unto Egypt. Wow, how about that? So he got sold into slavery. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned to his brethren and said, The child is not. And I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, This have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no. Now, of course, they knew, didn't they?
Yeah.
But they're acting like they don't know. You know, does this look like Joseph's coat? And he knew it, and said, It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. He rent his clothes, and he tore his clothes off. He put on sackcloth, which is like burlap, to show his humility to God, and he mourned. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him. You know, he had daughters too. But he refused to be comforted. And he said, For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and the captain of the guard. So he got sold into slavery. But what do we know about Joseph? God was with him. Back in Acts chapter 7, verse 10, it says, Well, the patriarchs moved with envy and sold Joseph into Egypt, and God was with him, verse 10, and delivered him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom in the sight of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he made him governor over Egypt and all his house. That's a very quick summary of what happened. Okay? But we know he got sold to this guy in chapter 39, verse 2. So he got sold to this guy, Potiphar. Potiphar's wife makes a move on Joseph. He refuses, so she makes it look like he tried to take advantage of her. And so Potiphar throws Joseph in jail, which probably could have killed him and not been a big deal. But he threw him in jail. And verse 39, verse 2, it says, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian." So here he was a prosperous man with Potiphar. He was the head of his house, and God was with him, so he prospered. Then he gets thrown into jail. Verse 21, it says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison." So first he's a slave and he prospers because God's with him. Then he gets thrown into prison and he prospers because God was with him. Verse 23, it says, "And the keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand, because the Lord was with him, with Joseph, and that which he did, the Lord made it to prosper." Wow, pretty crazy. So then, you know, he gets this thing where the Pharaoh dreams a dream and nobody can interpret it. So finally he finds out that Joseph could interpret dreams. And so then Pharaoh makes him his steward over Egypt. And he was 30 years old at the time. So from the time he was 17, we first pick up the story, now he's 30. So some years have passed. Joseph lived to be 110 years old. He was still in charge of Egypt. So he ruled Egypt for 80 years. It's a long time. It's a long time to be in charge. God delivered Joseph from slavery and from prison. It was God who gave Joseph favor and wisdom in Pharaoh's eyes, and Pharaoh promoted him. Okay, let's go back to Acts chapter 7. And verse 11, "Now there came a dearth over all the land of Egypt and of Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance." A dearth is a famine. You know, nothing's growing, there's no water, the animals start dying, and so it was over the whole area of Egypt and in Canaan. And there was great affliction, and their fathers found no sustenance, meaning they were having trouble feeding themselves. Verse 12, "But when Jacob heard that there was corn in Egypt, he sent out our fathers first." Okay, corn is not corn like we understand it. They didn't have corn then. Corn comes from the Americas. But if you look in a dictionary, a good dictionary, you'll see that corn is a generic term for grain, for wheat, for barley, for whatever. And it's all called corn generically. So when you see the word corn in the Bible, it doesn't refer to corn on the cob. Yellow corn, popcorn, Indian corn, all that stuff. It refers to any cereal grain that they may be growing. Okay? So we heard there was corn in Egypt. And why was there corn in Egypt? Because Joseph figured out and had stored up enough corn in the good years so that when the famine came, Egypt became extremely wealthy because they could sell the food. So he sent the patriarchs there, Jacob did, he sent his sons there, and they did not recognize Joseph, and Joseph was kind to them, kind of, and then he sent them back to their father, and he said, "Bring your father back here." So verse 13, "And the second time Joseph was made known to his brethren." When he came back, he was made known. He made himself known. He revealed who he was. "And Joseph's kindred was made known unto Pharaoh. Then sent Joseph and called his father Jacob to him and all his kindred, 75 souls." Brought the whole family and they had a reunion. 75 people started out with Jacob, 12 sons, and now 30 years later, there's, or 40 years later, there's 75 of them. So they're growing pretty quick. So Jacob went down to Egypt and he died, he and our fathers. So our fathers refers to the sons, the brothers of Joseph. There were 12 of them all together. That's why it's called the 12 tribes of Israel, right? Okay, verse 16, and they were carried over to Sichem or Shechem and laid in the sepulchre that Abraham bought for a sum of money for the son of the sons of Amor, the father of Shechem. Okay, now I want to read a note out of the working translation because he explains a little bit of that. And it's on page 44. It's down at the bottom. The sepulchre that Abraham bought. The sons of Hamor, or Emor in the Greek text, were Canaanites who occupied the area around Shechem. Although Jacob had bought a property at Shechem from the sons of Hamor, where he built an altar according to Genesis 33:18-20, Abraham also built an altar at Shechem as recorded in Genesis 12:6-7. Thus it is to be understood that Abraham had also purchased a property from the sons of Hamor at Shechem. This is not to be confused with the property that Abraham purchased near Hebron from the sons of Heth as recorded in Genesis 23:1-20. For a further discussion of property purchased by Abraham, see Stephen, Full of Spirit and Wisdom, published in Scripture Consulting 22, or the other book that's bound, the blue one, whatever, it's the riches of the something. I can't remember. Okay, so remember it said that Abraham did not set foot or have a foot. He did not own anything, you know, according to God's promise. Well, he didn't. He bought this, but God promised to give him the land, the whole land. And he sets out, he tells Abraham, look to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west. He says, as far as you can see, it's all yours. Later on, he expands a little more and says, from the great water, which would be the Mediterranean Sea, over to whatever, I can't remember where, and from the river Euphrates down to Egypt, I think, or something. You know, it was a good amount of land. Well, Abraham just bought a couple of little plots. He bought a plot to build an altar, and they had a place where he could be buried, him and his wife. So that's what that was all about. Abraham bought a plot of land to bury Sarah, and God promised to give the promised land to Abraham. He didn't tell Abraham, I'm going to give you money so you can buy it. He said, I'm going to give it to you. Okay, verse 17. But when the time of the promise drew nigh, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt. Okay, the people had been down in Egypt. Joseph was the steward. He was second in command to Pharaoh, basically running Egypt for 80 years. And then the Pharaoh died. So we're going to look into Exodus. It says the time of the promise drew nigh. It means that as the years progressed, Israel prospered in Egypt and multiplied. But it caused some problems. So now we're going to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1 and verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful, increased abundantly, and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. And a lot of them. Started out with how many? 75 plus Joseph and his wife and two kids. So really there were 79. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. This was said to be a pharaoh of a different race. In the Septuagint it says it is of another kind. he did not know Joseph, according to verse 18 in Acts. And it says it here, he knew not Joseph. And he said unto the people, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, I read somewhere an explanation, and Israelites were basically herders. And this new Pharaoh that came in, whatever it was, he had a prejudice against herders. So that was one of the things. But who knows for sure. But whatever it was, he did not know Joseph. But God had already prophesied that something would happen, right? They would be put in bondage. And then they would be freed, and God would get even with the Egyptians, so to speak. So verse 10, he says, come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, the treasure cities of Pithom and Ramses. And the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Wow. They grew and grew and grew. Back in Acts. So it says, verse 17 again, but when the time of promise drew nigh, after the year, as the years progressed, which God had sworn to Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt as they got closer to the time where God would give them that land that he had promised them. They grew and multiplied in Egypt till another king arose, which knew not Joseph. The same dealt subtly with our kindred, our relatives, our ancestors. That Pharaoh, he was subtle. In other words, he wasn't doing good by him, but he was putting him in subjection. And evil entreated our fathers, so that they cast out their young children to the end they might not live. Okay, I got another note to read to you just to explain this a little bit. Most of you are familiar that Pharaoh said, we're going to kill all these kids, the males, so that we can stop their increase. Okay, where am I going here? Okay, so in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Okay, so in which time Moses was born and was exceeding fair and nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Exceeding fair, the Greek words rendered exceeding are to theo, which means to God. The Greek word rendered fair is estios, which literally means of the city, and may also be rendered elegant, urbane, noble, pleasant, or well-pleasing, comely, beautiful, fair, or of polished manners. Its only other occurrence in the New Testament is in Hebrews 11:23 regarding Moses as a baby. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper Astios, child, and they were not afraid of the king's commandment. It should be noted that his parents hid him by faith or believing, suggesting that they must have had information from God to believe. Exodus 2:2 says regarding Moses' mother that when she saw him, he was a goodly child. She hid him 3 months. The Hebrew word rendered goodly in Exodus is tob, T-O-B, which means good, pleasant, agreeable, or favorable. At 3 months old, Moses would not have exhibited goodness or polished manners. Thus, it is to be understood that what Moses' mother saw was from God, that Moses was to be such a person as described by both the Hebrew word in Exodus 2:2 and the Greek word in Acts 7:20, and in Hebrews 11:23. Stephen thus describes Moses as elegant to God, noble to God, or beautiful to God. For a further discussion of these records, see Stephen, full of spirit and wisdom in Scripture Consulting issue 22. Okay? So, now we're to Moses. We went to Abraham. We looked at Joseph. And now we're to Moses. Moses was, so we're going to keep reading here a little bit. So Moses was born. He was exceeding fair, nourished up in his father's house 3 months. Now, you know, of course, every mother thinks that their child is the most beautiful baby ever born. You know, but it's more than that, isn't it? You know, it's more than that. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. So Moses was raised up in the royal household of Egypt. He was trained in the ways of the Egyptians. He was educated. He was taught their manners. He was learned. And he was mighty or powerful in his words and deeds. Again, the three most important figures in the history of Israel, in the tribes of Israel, are Abraham, Moses, and David. Stephen has now referenced two of these men in his effort to prove that Jesus was the Christ. Verse 23. And when he, Moses, was a full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. This is pretty interesting. He's full 40 years old. He has been in Pharaoh's household since he was 3 months old. So 39 years, 9 months. Now, we know by going back that when Pharaoh's daughter took him out of the basket that she needed somebody to nurse him. And so there was a Hebrew servant. And she said, well, I know of a woman of the Hebrews. And she doesn't have a baby, and so she gives him right back to Moses' mother, and she nurses him and raises him until he's weaned, and then she gives him back to Pharaoh's daughter, right? But he was there for 39 years in Pharaoh's household, raised up and educated. And yet he went to visit his brethren, the Israelites, so he knew where he was from, where he came from. What his lineage was. Pretty interesting. Let's go back to, Exodus. I have Genesis there. It's supposed to be Exodus. Sorry about that. Scratch it out and write in Exodus. Exodus 2, 22. Oh, Exodus 1:22. Sorry. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. And there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son. And when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him for 3 months. And when she could no longer hide him, she took him for an ark of bulrushes and daubed it with slime and with pitch and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. Pitch is tar, right? Would make it waterproof. And his sister stood afar off to wit what would be done of him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. And when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him and said, there is one of the Hebrews' children. Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages. And the woman took the child and nursed it. So she got paid for it on top of it. God always does cool things. And the child grew, and she brought him up unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses, and she said, because I drew him out of the water. And it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and he spied an Egyptian smiting in Hebrew one of his brethren. Now, it doesn't say here about him being full 40 years old, does it?
No.
So that's something that Stephen adds to the information. It may say it later on in Exodus, but not here. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him, what did the wrong? Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? And he said, who made thee prince and judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian? And Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses, but Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So that's what happened to Moses. Back to Acts. So again in verse 23, and when he was full 40 years old, he came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian, which we just read, he killed the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them, but they understood not. Now this is really interesting because it doesn't say that in Exodus, does it? So that's new information that, adds our understanding from what it says in Exodus. And God gave this to Stephen by revelation. So already way back then, Moses knew that he was sent for the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. Pretty amazing. Now, I think this is really interesting because the Jews make such a big deal about Moses. If you go back and look at some of the discussions between Jesus Christ and the Pharisees, say, wow, we follow the law of Moses, and Moses sits on the throne, and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But Stephen points out that their forefathers rejected Moses, not just once, but several times, many times, and tried to rebel against him. What did they do with the Christ? Same thing. You know, they made themselves to be such holier than thou, and pointed out to their love for Moses, but then Stephen says, well, look at the line you come from. They rejected Moses, and you reject the Christ. Verse 26, the next day he showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one another? But he that did his neighbor wrong thrust him away, saying, who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? Then fled Moses at this saying, and was a stranger in the land of Midian, where he begot two sons. You know, he left Egypt. You know, the Israelites rejected him. They said, who made you a ruler? They didn't want to hear about it. When he came back later on, they rejected him again. They said, why should we follow you? And then when they took him out into the desert, they said, well, you only brought us out here to starve us to death so that we would die. You know, again and again and again, they rejected him. Moses leaves Egypt, and we would say he was a fugitive because Pharaoh was going to slay him. But he came back when Pharaoh was gone, and God was with him, instructing him and assuring him. So I got a couple other verses there, but you can read those yourself about Hebrews 11, 23 through 27, where it talks about Moses. And again, we just read Exodus 2:15. So that's where we're going to end tonight. But that's quite a summary that Stephen does. And he's not sitting there reading a Bible. He doesn't have notes. He's just letting it go. He's just listening to God and speaking it forth and taking them through the history. And they're going to convict themselves because he shows them how they're not so great after all. So that's how far we're going to get tonight.